It is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones with you, along with the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor Bruce Helmer, and senior vice president and financial advisor Peg Webb. Hello to both of you. I'm back in the saddle, although I wish I was back in Florida.
Good morning, Susie. Nice. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, guys.
Hi, Peg Webb. Hello. Hello, Susie Jones. Welcome home.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've got one more week down here, Peg, and then I'm going back to join Susie back in Minnesota. But it sounds like the weather in Minnesota today. I'm glad I'm not there.
Oh no,
hey, Susie.
Yeah,
we have an interesting topic today. But before we get to it, Peg and I were kind of texting each other before the show, and I said, Peg, and I hope you agree, I think we have to mention the market. When the Dow drops over 700 points on Friday, it's probably still on people's minds on the weekend. But I guess the first thing I would remind everybody is, remember, stocks are a long-term investment. I think most listeners still remember the crash of 2008. In October of 07, the Dow was trading at a little over 14,000. By March 09, just 18 months later, it was about 60% less. It was trading at 6,000 and something. Well, the Dow today, even after Friday's retraction, is over 41,500. When we throw these indexes around and the points they gained or lost, I think sometimes we lose sight of what we're actually investing in. When we're investing in stocks, we're investing in smart, innovative, efficient, well-run companies that hopefully and usually will appreciate and go up in value over time. But there can be times along the way that you hit some bumps or hit some roadblocks, and we're certainly, the market so far this year has been a little bit of a bumpy, rocky ride. But you got to stay focused on the long term and not get too hung up on the weekly or daily movement up or down in the market. Peg, I know you had some stuff that you wanted to talk about with regard to the market also.
Bruce, I don't want to go backwards. I want all the money that I've earned, the last five-year average of 15-plus percent in the S&P 500, and I don't want to give any of it back. You know, so I think we actually are being very realistic, and the S&P is now down 5.1%. But a couple of weeks ago, Bruce, when you were gone, I said to the listeners, don't look at it as, points, because the media loves to say, just like you did, you said 700 points. You know, well, what does that really mean? Year to date, we're down 5.1% on the S&P. So I think actually a lot of people are hanging in there. There's shows like this. There's lots of history showing that, you know, if it's long-term money, leave it long. But our investment team, if you go to wealthenhancement.com under insights, and if you hit blog, Doug Huber, who's our deputy chief investment officer at Wealth Enhancement Group, did a 9-minute video on seven market movers. I thought it was excellent. He talks about the global economic growth. He talks about interest rates, inflation, and investor confidence. And so in a very short time on a video, you can get up to date. And this is something that we're going to do weekly. So I really encourage listeners to go look at that and listen and actually watch. I love watching videos versus having to read. Bruce?
Yeah, and the other thing I would say about that, Peg, and then we'll get into today's topic, Susie and listeners. We provide that information for anybody. You do not have to be a client of Wealth Enhancement. Anybody can go to the website and get that information, and we're, you know, not to toot our horn, but we're proud to do that. We're happy to do that. If it helps people, we're glad to help people. But I agree with you. I think it really is educational to the layperson that doesn't understand all these things. In 9 minutes, I think you can have a pretty good grasp of what's going on. And especially if you are nervous right now, I think it's a great listen. Peg, can you give the information one more time before we jump in this topic, how they find that?
Yes, so wealthenhancement.com. And then at the top, you're going to see categories like individual and families, and then businesses, and then insights. And if you pull that down, there's blog, B-L-O-G, and then it'll pop right up. It's the first thing on the page. So easy peasy. And then that's also where our radio shows are located. Your Money Radio Show is also one of those clicks under insights.
Good stuff. And people, have to, you want to take advantage of that. Okay, Peg, today's topic is planning for a 60-year career. And when I say that out loud, I can just imagine listeners going, 60-year career? Who's going to work for 60 years? But the data out there is very overwhelming that people are, because of longer life expectancy, sometimes it's economic necessity, sometimes it's just the joy of work or the sense of purpose, but people are working longer than ever before. And what does that mean in terms of planning for it? Now, again, not everybody listening is going to have a 60-year career, but I'll use myself or pick on myself as the example. I've got, 45 years of working under my belt right now, and I don't plan on stopping anytime soon, so I don't know if I'll have a 60-year career, but I'm probably going to be over 50-year career by my choice. I've said many times on this show, I don't do anything that I like better than this, so why would I stop doing this? And I know I'm a blessed person that I'm able to say that. Not everybody loves their job as much as they love mine. I get that. But some people work for the love of it, like I do. Some people need to work longer economically. But what planning things do we need to talk about for this longer working career than we've ever had before? Peg?
Bruce, I'm wondering, did you not include when you were 12 years old, corn, whatever you did in the cornfields? And then I worked serving coffee at the New Prague Hotel when I was 12. So if we add those years, but I actually thought that this was a typo when it said 60-year career. I said, whoa, wait a minute. Did you mean 40? Because that's kind of the common time frame. And, people are living longer, and we're seeing this in our practice. And we've already seen this, in the last 10 years for sure, where people are like, wow, I'm 65, I'm 75, and look at me. I've got longevity. I'm still doing all the things I want to do. And so we feel as financial planners, we do have to plan for a lot longer income streams. So as longer careers extend your income, people are a little bit reluctant to quit a job. And what I'm finding is that when clients go to say, hey, I'm retiring, these corporations are saying, whoa, we would love you to stay part-time. I mean, there's value in what they know, and they've been with these companies for a long time. And so then they come back to us and say, can you input that into my financial plan? I mean, what impact would that be if I work 20 hours a week for another 3 years or something? And it can be impactful because you're not taking money out of those buckets. They're going to continue to grow and be able to produce income, down the road. You may be able to leave that money for a couple more decades. So the other concern, Bruce, is, and Susie, is the solvency of Social Security. This is actually a mainstream item right now where, what changes, because it sounds like they need to make some changes. Congress needs to do something to keep the system going. And so that concerns our clients. And then also just planning for a transition of lower income. Now, hopefully, when you're thinking about these income streams, you're doing some homework or you're looking at what's the value of my accounts estimated, and then how much money can I create? So there's still that three-legged stool, right? There's pensions, and if you're a government worker, you're a teacher or something, you have a pension. Social Security is something we rely on, and then the third leg is creating your own income. And I would say that's the toughest one that you have to do alone, or you get help. Bruce.
Yeah, so Peg, on any topic, I always think in my brain, I create an outline or bullet point. So if we're talking about planning for this 60-year career, the first bullet point, I guess, that you kind of just covered was the financial implications of an extended career. And you talked about longer income stream and diversified income sources and the three-legged stool and so forth. But then maybe the next item or the next bullet point is strategically, how do we plan differently, or what strategies or vehicles or what concepts do we use for as part of our 60-year career?
Yeah. You know, I actually put my own item on here in big letters before I even talk about other retirement savings vehicles, and that is starting earlier, starting investing earlier. Just educating people on the power of compounding, and yourself. If you're 40, 50, 60 years old, you have decades of time. So the power of compounding adds interest on your interest that you would otherwise not have. If you didn't have the money in there earning something and you leave it in there and you don't take the income out, start early. So I wanted to start with that, because even if you haven't done it yourself, go educate somebody about the power of compounding. The other vehicles that, of course, people are really jumping on is self-employed plan IRAs, solo 401ks, Roth IRAs. We've all heard about these tax advantages that you can defer your tax. You do need to be a little careful, because you're still going to have a big IOU to the IRS if you, continue to compound tax deferred. Roth IRAs, more and more people are depositing money in a Roth through their employer because they want to have a balanced portfolio, not all money deferring, but having some money that's growing tax-free. The other big item is healthcare and insurance planning. So longer careers, actually, that might prolong your life. You stay active. Mentally, you're doing something that's, stretching your brain ability. But when it comes to wealth doesn't even matter when some kind of health event happens. And so you need to plan for that, though. And we're still a big proponent of educating people on long-term care and what resources will you have. Do you have a health savings account that you could utilize? And then lastly, Bruce, it's just a repeat of a financial plan. You need some money that's going to be an emergency fund that for the what ifs. We get the phone call a lot where it said, guess what happened to me? And we need ready resources to be able to help the client in whatever surprise that they just got. Bruce?
Yeah, a couple thoughts. That's good stuff, Peg. With regard to retirement plans, whether it's a 401k, 403b, 457, but the company retirement plan, I tell people all the time, it's important to participate in those plans. Now, you can do it in the traditional way and have your dollars go in pre-tax and get a deduction for the contribution. Or now most of these plans offer a Roth option that don't give you immediate tax gratification, but may give you greater tax gratification down the road, and that if you use it correctly, it's completely tax-free. The reason I like these vehicles is it's so easy to participate, right? They just withhold the money from your paycheck. Peg, I think you use the expression hide money from yourself. I sometimes say pay yourself first, but if we had to write a check out every month for the amount that we contribute to our company retirement plan, a lot of us wouldn't do it a lot of months. But when it's just withheld from your paycheck, it's easy to participate, right? So, and then oftentimes these plans come with some sort of a matching contribution from your employer. So I tell people all the time, look, if you've got a plan where your employer will match you 50 cents on the dollar up to the first 4% or something like that, that's like a 50% rate of return. Wealth enhancement's good, but we're not going to probably make you a 50% rate of return. So for most people, participating in their company plan should be one of their top priorities, as opposed to investing with somebody like us or somebody in our industry. Don't misunderstand. We want to work with you and we want to help you invest your money. We want to help you plan. But part of efficient planning and part of our responsibility as a fiduciary is to give you the best possible advice, and participating in that company plan for most people is a wise first thing to do. So I'm glad that you brought that up. Then you also mentioned, healthcare, insurance, a rainy day fund, emergency fund. Most people don't have it, and you should. We focus with people on that all the time. So those are all, I think, sub-points of this strategic planning. What about adapting to the transition of your, if you ever do leave your 60-year career?
I love this. I love this career transition tips here, because continuous skill development, investing in your education and training to stay relevant, it's just such a great proactive approach. It can actually open new opportunities and preserve your earnings potential. Bruce, I'm surrounded with people and friends and family who want to continuously have different skills. And the main reason is why, because we're reading about, if you don't keep, your mind active and stretching for learning things and gaining new skills, I think we've witnessed now, and there's some studies that say, if you just watch TV, it's not going to be enough to keep your mind sharp. And I think we're all being educated well on that. So people are out there trying to take classes at college universities and read books and keep up with, these new games. I'm actually a big gamer person. And just so you know, I don't like to lose. Right. So
surprise.
If you play games with me, it's going to be a little competitive. And then it goes with the other things is lifelong learning. So I mentioned this, just learning, reading, and then financial planning. There's flexible financial planning where you can take part-time roles as a consultant. I already brought that up, that not only our clients weren't thinking about that, but then the employer reached out to them and said, hey, we still need your skill. And would you go research this new development that we have within our company, because we think you'd be good in doing some testing for us. So a lot of these things are career transitions, and I see people, I can just see them beaming with, this next approach to retirement, but yet they're not going to have, no income coming in, and it's going to boost their longevity of assets for themselves and probably for family down the road. Bruce?
Peg, this is all related and this is important stuff, and we do talk about it, and some people might say, why are you talking about health and wellness and purpose? And it's because it's related to your finance. And Peg, I know you would agree with me. When I look at clients over the years in terms of how they get on with their life post-retirement, the clients that stay active physically and mentally, that take classes, that learn new things, that get out on the golf course, that play pickleball, that take walks, I see them age so much better and stay youthful, as opposed to the people that become very sedentary. And sometimes it's the opposite, that maybe you become sedentary because you've got some sort of physical thing preventing you from being active. But the retirement and the enjoyment of retirement is just so much better for those people that are able to stay active both physically and mentally. And it does matter to your joy and your happiness, your quality of life in retirement. Okay, so we talked about, with regard to this this career, we talked about financial implications, we talked about strategic planning for the 60-year career, we talked about adapting to the, or transitioning. I guess the last part is rethinking what traditional retirement looks like, Peg.
Yeah, and some of that is just that phase retirement that I talked about, just gradually lessening your hours and you transition out. And a lot of times you're training the person that's going to replace you, but many of these companies now are keeping you on for a year or two to train the person and not just saying, hey, you're leaving in 60 days. It's all left to you. people with long-term careers in these companies, they want to leave with that last purpose. And then once again, I can't help but say, you know, your financial plan has to align with your personal goals and your passion and what your vision is for what you can do. And we can then put that all in numbers and make sure that it works out for you and your family. You know, it's just a huge time in your life, Bruce.
You know, I'll close with this, Susie. I know we're about out of time in the first half here, but Peg, you know, my experience for people in their mid-60s, which I now am, was my parents. And my parents in their mid-60s, they were old. If I would have thought of myself 20 years ago in my mid-40s, what I would be like in my mid-60s, it was based on the experience of my parents. And I would have thought, I'm old. I'm shouting at kids to get off my lawn. But I'm not that person. I'm in my mid-60s, and I'm not going to tell you I could do everything I could do in my mid-40s, but I haven't slowed down much. And so this 60-year career thing is real. And maybe, Susie, there's one or two things we'll touch on in the second half, but mostly it'll be listener questions.
That sounds great. And let's remind people listening right now, if they have a question they want to text or call 651-461-9226. Again, 651-461-9226. And we are back for the second half of the show. Once again, here is the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group, Bruce Helmer, and Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor, Peg Webb. Welcome back to both of you. We have a number of questions to get to, but if you want to recap that first half hour, that would be great. Bruce?
Thank you, Susie Jones. Thank you, listeners, for sticking in there with us. If you joined us late, Peg and I talked about planning for a 60, and that's not a typo, 60-year career. I don't need to rehash the whole thing. Peg, is there anything, any key takeaways, anything that you wanted to mention or emphasize from the first half? Otherwise, we can let listeners drive the second half. I promised last week we would get to more questions this week. Peg?
Yes, and I actually think let's go to callers because it looks like we've got quite a few.
Yes.
And then if we have a little gap, we can continue with the outline.
All right, let's start with this one. At 651-461-9226, the texter writes, do 501c3 organizations pay taxes if they are my contingent beneficiary on 403b tax deferred account?
So 501c3, Peg, I think the texter is calling or is referring to a charitable organization. I think that's the section of the tax code that's a charitable organization or a church. And by definition, these charities don't pay income taxes, correct?
Correct. They do not. So one of the things that people maybe don't know is this 501c3 organization. This is based on the IRS, right? So when people come to us and say, hey, I would like to take advantage of taking my required minimum distribution or dollars out of my IRA and directly send it to a nonprofit organization. Well, one of the things you have to do is make sure that it's a 501c3 organization, because there's other charities out there that don't bother setting up this 501c3, and there's multiple reasons for that. They have to fill out all these forms, they have to follow all these rules, and one of the things that they benefit from for having the 501c3 is that they're donations are tax-free. Now, they have lots of rules and regulations, like I mentioned, and they have to follow, you know, strictly to be able to keep that status of the 501c3. And so, but once you give that money to them, they're not paying tax, provided they're following all the rules, Bruce.
I wonder if even what inspired that texter. In the first half of the show, I talked about company retirement plans, and I said 401k or 403b or 457, which is very different than a charitable organization. But the commonality, again, we use all this terminology in our industry and we use all these acronyms, but 401k, 457, 403b, 501c3, these are all subsections, sections and subsections of a very vast comprehensive tax code, and we're just citing the number and sub number of the tax code, but there's a lot of different stuff in that tax code, and I think sometimes when we say 401k, people wonder where does that name even come from. It's just a section of the tax code that allows you to put away money on a pre-tax basis and not pay the taxes until you draw it out, and then there's a requirement when you start to draw it out. So after they give the number of the code, then they give what the code means, but we just cite 401k or that section of the tax code. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, this might not apply to the show, but I turned 65 in April. I applied for Medicare 2 months ago, waiting to hear. I've not heard. Is Social Security says they're reviewing my application. Kind of wondering. That's not a bad question. I'm sure you get that from people. Like, what's the timeline? How long should you expect to wait? Is that something you can address?
Yeah, it absolutely is applicable. And again, we'll take any and all financial questions, not just on today's topic. So, Peg, maybe we dive in a little bit just to the logistics of reaching the age of 65, and when do you file for Medicare, and how does that work, and what if you want to draw your Social Security? Logistically, how does that work? We could talk a little bit about that, and I should also give listeners a heads up. We're trying sooner than later. I don't know if we've pinpointed a date yet, but we're trying to do our Social Security in-depth show again with our friend Rhonda Whitenack from the Social Security Administration. We'll give you a heads up when that show's coming. But talk a little bit, Peg, about logistically the process of reaching these milestone ages and having to jump through these hoops.
Yeah, it's interesting because 65 is really the milestone for Medicare. And for you and I, Bruce, and maybe it's not you, you're a little bit older than I am, but my full retirement age is 67. So if you want to apply for retirement benefits, you can apply ahead of time. I think it's like 3 or 4 months ahead of time. Sounds like this person did 2 months ago. But if you want to start receiving your benefits, if you're just turning 65, you're probably going to have a reduced Social Security. But then some people who are retired, they want to have Medicare only and not choose to start their Social Security, which is A-okay. You're fine with that. If you don't have another work plan, you know, if you're working part-time and they're still allowing you to have any kind of health benefits, you're not going to want to go on Medicare. So that takes a lot of analysis, I believe. It's not just an easy question, but I think you can call the Social Security Administration. I know we all probably have our online account now, and if you don't, you should. But if you have questions, I believe they still answer the phone. You can just ask them, when should I expect, you know, what I've requested, Bruce.
Susie, I got a question for you. Have you noticed before how often Peg weaves into the conversation that I'm older than she is?
Yeah, you're so much older, Bruce.
Oh, dear.
But Peg, you raise a really, really, really good point. I think there is a lot of confusion because people do equate Social Security and Medicare as one thing, and obviously they're not. They're two things. So, yes, you can be eligible for Medicare benefits at age 65, but Social Security, you've actually got an 8-year window. You can start your benefits as early as age 62, and you'd never want to wait any later than age 70 at the very latest. But everybody has what's called a retirement age based on your birthday. And as Peg mentioned, hers is 67, mine is 66 years and 10 months. That's when I could receive full Social Security benefits. But whether or not you want to turn those on is like Peg said, is a trickier question. And from the logistical standpoint in terms of doing it, and I don't have this information at my fingertips, Peg, but we provide for clients and prospective clients all the time. Here's the phone, here's the free phone number, or here's the website. Here's where you go to get help. If you want help with Medicare or you want help with Social Security, we will help people do that. I don't have those in front of me or memorized, but that's pretty standard operating procedure that will help people negotiate that when they get to that point in their life. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, I have to start taking my RMD this year. I have three ITAs in separate places. Do I have to take all of them out now?
So, Peg, required minimum distribution. Let's go over it again, how it works. And even though we talk about it a lot, I think there's still a lot of confusion on it. And so this person has multiple accounts and they're not sure what to do.
Yes. So obviously you turn 73 because that's the new magic age that you have to do required minimum distributions. I think some of the confusion is lots of people had to start at 70 and a half, and then they're continuing to push that out because of that longevity we talked about in the beginning of the show. People are just living longer. Well, if you have three IRAs and they're in separate accounts, or even if they're under different custodians, you have a couple things you can do. You can actually defer taking any money out this year, and you have till April 15th of next year. It might actually be April 1st, but you have till next year to take that out. The reason that they are allowing that is, let's say you worked part-time this year, and you feel like, oh, I don't want that required minimum distribution on top of my employment. And so you have a chance to say, okay, I'm going to push that till April of tax year of next year. But what you have to do then next year is take two distributions, one for 2025 and then one for 2026. So I don't see people doing that too often. If you have three IRAs, you can collectively combine them all. You don't have to combine them in a particular account. Just do your math, total them up, and you can take the percentage out of one of those accounts, and it will be calculated as your 2025 required minimum distribution. The old rule we used to have to take a little bit from each one, but now they allow you to combine them and then take the percentage out. And I like that, because what if one of them is in the stock market and it's down and you don't want to take from that one, and you have some money market maybe in another IRA, and maybe that's what you should take out for this year. So that's the flexibility that they've given us now, which I do like. Bruce?
Yeah, it was a really good answer, Peg. The only thing I'm going to add is to that point you just made, that the value of the accounts can vary. How do you determine what you base your percentage distribution on? And it really goes back to the account balance on December 31st of the previous year. So to the texter, on those three IRAs, whatever the balance was on December 31st, that's what your RMD is based on. It doesn't matter that the value might have gone down, you know, from December 31st until the end of March. It's based on the December 31st number, but everything else Peg said, spot on. You got to add them all together to determine what your minimum is, but you don't have to take them out of every account. In terms of how much it is, at age 73, it's roughly 4% of the total. So if you have $100,000 cumulatively in IRAs, you're going to have to take out around $4,000. And I'll say this also, Peg, sometimes it makes sense to do some consolidating and get all your IRAs under one roof. I know at Wealth Enhancement Group, if everybody has all their IRAs with us, they never have to worry about RMD, because we proactively, as soon as we get that December 31st account balance, usually in the first quarter then of the following year, we proactively reach out to our clients, tell them, here's the amount that you have to take out this year, and here's the account that we think you should take it from. And it's really pretty seamless for them. We do the work for them. So it may be to people's benefit to do some consolidating for that reason, and maybe some other reasons as well. Susie?
651-461-9226. A texter writes, good morning. My father-in-law passed away recently, and we will be selling his house in Texas. With that money and a few other bank accounts, we are set to inherit some money. Is it okay to use a little bit of that money for some necessary home improvements before we put the house, the rest away, into an emergency savings account and investments? For example, our house needs a new roof and siding and a new driveway.
What a good question. So, Peg, there's nothing precluding them from using some of that money to enhance the home before they sell it, is there?
No, the only thing I was thinking of is because there are some rules about, you know, if it was their permanent home and if the value of it was more than $250, but that's when they're alive. So, yeah, so I think I don't believe there's any reason that they couldn't use it for whatever they want. Now, maybe they're working with an attorney to, because I don't know Texas law. I don't know if there's anything state-wise that they may have to use some of that inheritance to pay for. So I think it's a matter of just researching and maybe get some legal help to make sure that you don't have any obligations. But otherwise, you can use the money for whatever you want, Bruce.
Yeah, that's what I think, too. And again, that's a good answer, Peg, because if you're not sure about some of that stuff and you want to consult an attorney, there's probably somebody, an attorney that's already drafted those legal documents that you already know and maybe even have a relationship with. But you said something that got my brain going down a different road, and I apologize to the texter because this is not an answer to the texter's question. But in kind of thinking out loud through it, Peg, you were talking about the exclusion. I find that there's still a ton of confusion. I get this question multiple times a year. People are going to sell a home. They're still alive. Nobody died. But they're going to downsize or they're going to move to a senior apartments or whatever. They're going to sell their single-family home. And they're worried about the tax consequences on the gain. And most people don't realize that for the vast, vast, vast majority of people, there isn't going to be any taxes. You only have to pay long-term capital gains taxes. If you're a single filer, your gain is more than $250,000. So if you paid $250,000 for a home and you sell it for $500,000, that's not a taxable event. That's a gain of $250,000. Now, if you sold it for $600,000 and your basis or the amount you paid for the home was $250,000, then you'd have to pay taxes on the $100,000 over and above that $250,000 of gain. If you're a married couple filing jointly, the gain can be $500,000. So if you bought a house for $300,000 and you're selling it for $750,000, married filing jointly, that's not a taxable event. People still think that there's taxes, and or to avoid the taxes, they have to buy another home. But you don't. It doesn't matter what you do with those proceeds. So very, very, very few people have so much gain and appreciation in their home that they're actually going to have to pay taxes on selling the home. And the other thing, Peg, and again, I think you kind of did this as you were thinking out loud, to qualify as residents so you don't have to pay the taxes, you just have to have lived in the home or established residency, homesteaded, for two of the previous 5 years. Doesn't even have to be all five, two of the previous five, and you can sell that home tax-free. It wasn't the texter's question, but you made me think of it, and it's a question I still get multiple times a year. Anything else you wanted to add on that, Peg?
No, I think we just made it well known that there's a few things you should investigate. And if you're not working with an attorney, there might be, you know, property tax that you still owe, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we did a good job of just saying that there's a lot to investigate before you may start just spending this money. Bruce?
Susie.
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, I am age 63. My wife is age 61. I plan to take Social Security at 67. My wife plans to take Social Security at 62. When I reach 67, can my wife switch to a spousal benefit if it is higher than the benefit based on her earnings?
Oh, wow. Okay, so Peg, this is a classic example of Social Security planning and two partners, married couple, both are eligible for Social Security. How do we coach them up to try to maximize that benefit? Because there's some strategies here, and I have to raise my hand right away and say, off the top of my head, even as Susie was reading the question, I'm like, I don't remember exactly how that works. Do you?
Well, what I do know is if the 61-year-old wife, when she reaches 62 and she's going to start Social Security, that will be a reduced amount. You already talked about that, Bruce, where if you take it earlier, you're going to get a reduced amount. At 67, the 63-year-old is planning on taking full retirement age. And so then there is what's called a spousal benefit. And the spouse does get 50% of the higher of the two. The negative here, though, is if you apply for that, 61 years old, they're going to do some kind of a formula. And I don't know this off the top of my head right now, but they're going to do some type of a formula to see if 50% of his, and I believe they go back to what hers would be full retirement age. So we'd have to make darn sure that the rules, are clear. And so, I'd have to look that up just to make sure. I know we have software that we use at Wealth Enhancement Group to make recommendations like this to clients, whether that makes sense for them or not, but I don't have that software in front of me. Bruce?
Yeah, and I'll close with this, Susie, because I think we're almost out of time. I'll close with this. I also don't remember exactly all the variations. And again, this is a topic we can go into in great detail when we do our entire show devoted to Social Security. But what I can say is our planners, on my team, my planner, Nicole, knows these rules and has this software, and we can do the planning and make a recommendation on how you should draw your benefits. But I always caution clients that this is never going to be an exact science, right? Because there's certain things we don't know. There's a lot of things that we do know, and we take what we do know, and we load that into the software, and we do the forecast. But there's things that we don't know that we have to make assumptions on, the biggest of which is we don't know when you're both going to die. So we assume what is most logical, what is most reasonable, and then we do those forecasts and projections and make that recommendation to enhance your chances of maximizing that benefit. But it's never going to be an exact science because it just can't be. So I know that's not a good answer to the texter today, but we can provide that information. I just don't know how to do it right now in my head on the show. But it's something we do standard operating procedure. All right. Susie, I know we're about out of time. Great question today. Thank you, listeners.
And we want to remind people, if you did not get your question answered, you can email it to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com, or you can call 888-6-ADVICE, and someone will get back to you, 888-6-ADVICE.